So when you are told to prepare for a crisis management scenario, what usually flashes through your mind?
Oh, probably whiteboards. Maybe a flowchart.
Right. A consultant in a sharp suit using words like, synergy or pivot strategies and risk mitigation.
Exactly, analyzing variables from a safe, sterile distance.
But I mean, what happens when you strip away that safety net?
Oof.
What happens when you swap out the whiteboard for the ice-choked architecture of the destroyer's keep?
Yeah, and you swap the consultant for a commander who's literally dodging the spectral blade of his undead best friend.
Exactly, because the variables suddenly become incredibly visceral. You are no longer managing a theoretical crisis,
Oh no, you are undergoing the ultimate stress test for leadership. I mean, there is no time to form a committee. Every single decision carries an immediate and often lethal consequence.
And that is exactly what we are dissecting today on this deep dive. We are taking the source material, and Love Thomas and his crew infiltrating Lord Eowyn's stronghold, and we are extracting the underlying mechanics of it.
Because we aren't just recounting a fun adventure here.
No, not at all. Our mission today is to map out the anatomy of high-stakes problem-solving, the brutal psychology of conflict, and the incredibly nuanced art of crisis leadership hidden right there in the pages.
And honestly, it is a masterclass in tactical adaptability. You've got this ensemble, Cass Thomas, Lady Redmayne, Rachel, Sir Lefalon, and Ahern, the Lord of the Horses.
Right, they're sneaking in to rescue two key figures and locate an artifact.
Yeah, and they are operating in an environment that is designed to be completely hostile to their survival. The keep isn't just a physical fortress, it's a psychological weapon.
Surviving it requires this constant recalibration of tactics.
Yeah.
I mean, you need more than just sharp swords. You need scratch nails, psychological warfare, and literally burying your demons mid-battle.
It's wild. They pivot from profound empathy to cynical deception, and then finally to just unyielding conviction.
Well, okay, let's unpack this. Let's look at the mechanics of that very first pivot. You know the opening sequence at the bottom of the stairwell?
Oh, yeah.
Thomas confronts the wraith of his old friend Randall. And we all remember the visceral shock of that fight, right? Thomas lands a solid blow, draws that terrifying black ichor, and the wound just instantly knits back together.
Right, physical combat in that scenario is mathematically unwinnable.
It's a total war of attrition, where the enemy literally does not fatigue.
Because the Wraith is magically bound to serve the Destroyer. It's feeding off this corrupted loop of loyalty and dark magic. If Thomas just keeps swinging his sword, he exhausts himself and dies.
So the physical mechanism of the fight has failed. And Thomas completely shifts the paradigm. He targets the emotional foundation of the conflict.
Which is such a brilliant move.
But he does it by actively building a grave mid-fight. Like, I want you to picture the sheer audacity of this.
It's incredible.
Thomas is parrying lethal, superhuman sword thrusts, and simultaneously he's barking orders at Rachel to gather Randall's scattered bones.
Yeah, and then Thomas himself drops down, scoops up rubble, and starts constructing a stone cairn.
Right. It is the equivalent of trying to negotiate a hostile corporate takeover while simultaneously planning the opposing CEO's retirement party.
That is a great way to put it.
I just struggle with the logistics of this. How does stopping to show empathy, like literally exposing yourself to physical danger to stack rocks, actually provide a tactical advantage?
Well, because you are looking at the physical risk rather than the psychological mechanism of the binding.
Okay, unpack that for me.
So, Randall's Wraith is anchored to the physical world by the Destroyer's dark magic, right? But that magic requires a foundation of trauma and dehumanization to maintain its hold.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the Wraith even taunts Thomas, calling the burial a petty tactic. It expects violence. It expects to be treated as a monster.
So by honoring his friend, by completing the ancient, deeply human ritual of a proper burial, Thomas introduces massive cognitive dissonance into the Wraith's programming.
Precisely. He refuses to engage with the armor. He speaks directly to the person trapped inside it. Laying the final stone on that cairn isn't just a nice gesture. It is a targeted strike against the spiritual anchor holding Randall in servitude. He validates Randall's humanity, and in doing so, he breaks the emotional chain that the dark magic relies upon.
Which completely recontextualizes the moment Rachel places the last stone. The hostile energy doesn't just fade because they finished a chore.
No, it dissipates because the corrupted loyalty has been neutralized.
And that allows Sir Lefalon to finally pierce the Wraith. And instead of reforming, Randall's spirit is actually freed.
Exactly. He regains enough autonomy to warn them about the gargoyle trap upstairs and passes back that jade brooch.
So empathy wasn't a distraction from the fight. It was literally the weapon that won it.
Thomas tells the dying Wraith, "I serve my heart and no other." It is this profound demonstration of maintaining core values under extreme pressure.
And for anyone listening who has ever had to navigate an opponent bound by toxic loyalty or maybe an incredibly oppressive system, the takeaway is vital.
Yeah, sometimes the only way to dismantle a hostile force is to remind them of their own dignity.
Totally. But here is where the text pulls the rug out from under you. Empathy and honor are fantastic for neutralizing the ghosts of the past. But what happens when the threat isn't a tragic, misunderstood figure?
Right. What happens when the threat is just a terrifying, faceless cog in a totalitarian machine?
Exactly. As the team ascends into the upper levels, the nobles' quarters, the rules of engagement completely flip. We transition from spiritual empathy to pure, cynical deception.
Because the environment demands it. They enter a space governed by rigid, fear-based hierarchy. You cannot empathize your way out of a bureaucratic nightmare.
You have to exploit it.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the mechanics of that exploitation, starting with the smallest, most brilliant detail, the scratched nail.
Oh, I love the nail.
They push up into that dusty storeroom, and before opening the door to the main hallway, Thomas takes an old nail, scratches it, and props it point up in the corner where the door meets the wall.
It is such a tiny moment, but it's pure genius. It is low-tech, high-reliability verification. When you are operating in a chaotic, high-stakes environment, you cannot rely solely on active observation. You need passive systems working in the background to provide accurate intelligence.
That nail tells him instantly and definitively if their rear flank has been compromised.
Which they need, because things immediately go sideways in the study.
Oh man, do they ever. Guy, the little stealthy lizard minion, warns them a guard is coming. They duck away, but Thomas gets cornered by Shadow.
This terrifying, faceless Wraith entity in a black robe.
Right. And now, I really have to push back hard on Thomas's strategy here. His cover is blown. Instead of drawing his sword, he instantly adopts the persona of an arrogant, demanding, incredibly evil nobleman.
It is an aggressive escalation.
It's incredibly reckless. He claims he knows the Destroyer's true name, Lord Eowyn, and throws a massive tantrum, refusing to sign a dark contract.
Yeah, he really leans into it.
But if I'm managing this crisis, I look at that move and see a catastrophic risk. It's the equivalent of walking into a highly secure military facility without a badge, getting caught by an armed guard, and just screaming at them for making you wait.
I mean, when you put it like that,
it relies entirely on the assumption that Shadow will be too intimidated to just stab him. If Shadow calls his bluff, the mission ends right there in a pool of blood. Where's the tactical logic in that?
Okay, your analogy of the military facility is accurate, but it misses the specific psychology of an authoritarian system.
How so?
Well, Shadow is not an autonomous guard. Shadow is middle management in a dictatorship. What Thomas is doing is expertly weaponizing the bureaucracy of evil.
Okay.
In rigid, fear-based hierarchies like the Keep, middle managers are paralyzed by the fear of stepping out of line. They lack the executive authority to make unilateral decisions.
Especially regarding someone who confidently claims to have leverage, like a true name, over their supreme leader.
Exactly. Shadow cannot risk executing a potentially valuable asset to the Destroyer.
So you're saying Shadow's fear of making a mistake is greater than his suspicion of Thomas?
Precisely. The bureaucratic consequence of killing an important VIP is far worse than the consequence of letting an arrogant nobleman yell at him. Thomas doesn't fight the system. He inserts himself at the top of the hierarchy and lets gravity do the work.
Okay, wow. I see the psychological leverage there.
Mm-hmm.
And while Thomas is putting on this theatrical display of arrogance, Guide is sneaking under the desk and stealing a silver fountain pen embossed with the initials JH.
Yes.
I always love that as a heist moment. But mechanically, why does the pen matter? Why risk blowing the whole cover for a piece of stationery?
Because in a realm bound by dark contracts and magical bureaucracy, a personalized pen isn't just a writing tool. It is physical collateral.
Right.
It represents the ability to forge a signet or claim authorized intent. Thomas is gathering tools to legitimize his bluff. He knows he has to maintain this disguise.
Which comes in handy immediately.
Sure.
Later, When the Goblin Guard and that foul-smelling rat killer investigate a noise near their hiding spot, Thomas uses the exact same psychological exploit.
He complains about rats.
Yeah, he acts deeply insulted that servants would disturb him and demands they clean it up. He uses their servile programming to completely control the narrative.
He keeps them so busy apologizing they forget to investigate the actual security breach.
It gives the team time to find the secret passage behind the guest wardrobe. It's brilliant. But, you know, bluffing a middle manager only gets you so far.
Sure.
You can fake your way into the building, you can exploit the bureaucracy, but eventually you have to actually locate your target. And in a fortress literally built on magical illusions, how do you verify you've found the right person?
And this transition from deception to verification is where the psychological toll on Thomas becomes glaringly apparent. It brings us to the discovery of Lord Raphael of April in the tower cell.
It is a brutal scene. They sneak up a servant's stairwell and find this gaunt, emaciated man staring at the ceiling in a locked cell.
Yeah.
Thomas has just spent all this time, risked everyone's lives, to find Lord April. Human instinct tells you to rush the bars, drop the disguise, and whisper, "Hey, we're here to rescue you."
But Thomas doesn't.
He stays in character as the evil nobleman. He walks up to the bars, hisses "Rise and Shine," and actively mocks the prisoner about not having any friends coming to save him.
Which feels incredibly cruel, particularly to an ally who has been subjected to prolonged isolation and psychological torture.
It is cruel. Mm. But when you look at the mechanics of the environment, it is basically a brutal form of two-factor authentication.
Oh, that's a good way to phrase it.
I look at this like a high-stakes cybersecurity phishing test. He has to be cruel to be safe. Thomas needs to gauge the prisoner's authentic reaction to ensure this isn't one of the destroyer's doppelgangers setting a trap.
Right. If Lord April immediately begs for mercy or acts out of character, Thomas knows it's an illusion.
Exactly.
It perfectly illustrates the burden of leadership. Thomas must ruthlessly prioritize the mission's integrity over basic polite greetings or immediate comfort.
His empathy, as we saw with Randall, is profound, but it is never naive.
Never. He waits until the prisoner responds with intelligent defiance. Lord April analyzes Thomas's glamour, the magical disguise, before Thomas finally drops the act.
And even then, Thomas doesn't just hand over a weapon. He demands a physical test. He reaches through the bars and makes Lord April push against his hand.
Because intel is useless if the asset can't be extracted, he needs to assess Lord April's muscle atrophy and combat readiness.
He has to know if the man can physically run when the inevitable alarms go off.
It is coldly pragmatic, but we really have to talk about Lord April's side of this equation because his resilience is just staggering.
Oh, absolutely. When Silifilon offers him a canteen, April mentions he would rather go thirsty than drink anything tainted with the spite of his jailers.
Yeah, the goblins tried to force him to beg for his food, and he just refused to eat.
Lord April represents the absolute mental fortitude required to survive a prolonged systemic crisis. He didn't just survive physically, he maintained the sovereignty of his dignity.
That refusal to consume tainted food is a powerful mechanism of psychological defense. By refusing their terms, he refused to let them contaminate his spirit.
And because he maintained that clarity, he is immediately useful to the operation. The second Thomas unlocks the cell, Lord April starts delivering verified intelligence.
Which, by the way, the mechanism of that unlocking is fascinating.
Oh, right. Thomas uses a magical flute, but plays it with minimal breath to avoid making noise.
It's a great detail. Using the precise, absolute minimum activation energy for a fey magic tool, so it achieves the goal without triggering the acoustic alarms.
Precision control in a volatile environment. And the intel he gains from April is critical.
Mm.
The destroyer's army has already departed on a flying boat pulled by an enslaved djinn.
And the Lord Protector is trapped out in the courtyard as a petrified unicorn statue.
Which brings us to the final, most chaotic phase of the infiltration. You've used empathy to clear the past. You've used deception to bypass the bureaucracy. You've rigorously verified your target. But now you have to take this complex, multi-objective checklist into a highly volatile, open environment, the courtyard.
This is where careful planning violently collides with the friction of reality. They have to rescue the djinn to secure their only viable escape route, and they have to revive the Lord Protector to fulfill Thomas's original oath.
All while being actively hunted by the Keep's security forces. And the execution here is pure adrenaline. Redmayne is passing out homemade firebombs, starting fires in the upper floors to pull the guards.
Yeah, and the courtyard is patrolled by Viglari, these giant, terrifying scorpion-like monstrosities.
Ahern, the Lord of the Horses, steps up to manage the crowd control. He leaps onto a crate, his eyes glowing with blue fire, and issues this massive, supernatural challenge to draw the Vaglari away from the boat.
It is a spectacular diversion that allows Thomas and Redmayne to split the primary objectives. Thomas realizes physical force won't break the magical shielding on the brass lamp binding the djinn.
Right, his sword fails.
Exactly. He needs a specific mechanism. He calls Redmayne over because her iron sword is anathema to fey magic. It can disrupt the tether.
So while Redmayne is literally hacking into the deck of the boat to shatter this lamp, Thomas sprints over to the unicorn statue. He starts circling it counterclockwise Widdershins, the universal magical direction for undoing or unraveling a spell.
Yeah.
He's chanting, "Stars and moon, sun and sky, let the dark powers pass by." But it's not enough. The magic is too dense. He feels a stir, but the statue remains heavy stone.
Meanwhile, Redmayne shatters the lamp. The iron disrupts the binding.
Yes, the djinn is free, flying around in pure joy, and she uses her magic to lift the entire heavy wooden boat into the air.
The extraction vehicle is secured and hovering. Redmayne, Rachel, Sir Luffalon, and Lord April are boarding. The Vaglari are charging past Ahern's distraction. The window for escape is closing in seconds.
And Thomas refuses to get on the boat.
He
plants his feet next to this massive stone unicorn. He tells his team to leave without him because he swore an oath to return with the Lord Protector. Now, I have to challenge this.
Go for it.
I cannot let Thomas off the hook here. He swore an oath. Fine. But dead leaders do not keep promises. He is actively risking Rachel, Luffalon Ahern, his entire team for a piece of petrified rock that he lacks the magical power to wake up.
I see where you're going.
In any standard crisis management playbook, that is a massive failure of leadership. You cut your losses, you secure the extraction, and you live to fight another day. Isn't this just a suicide mission masses ability?
Well, if you view leadership purely as a mathematical exercise and risk mitigation, then yes, it is a catastrophic liability. But Thomas is playing a completely different game here.
Okay, what game is he playing?
You have to look at the mechanism of absolute conviction. Thomas is operating in a world, and specifically inside a keep, that is defined entirely by broken promises, dark contracts, and betrayal. His unwavering word is his most powerful asset.
But his unwavering word is about to get his team eviscerated by giant scorpions. Where is the line between mission integrity and getting your people killed?
The line is drawn by the effect that conviction has on the surrounding variables, specifically the djinn. The djinn is a creature of transactional magic. She understands debts, bindings, and freedom. She is hovering above them, watching this unfold. She sees a human willing to sacrifice his own life and the guaranteed safety of an escape vehicle simply because he refuses to break an oath to a piece of stone.
It alters her calculation.
Profoundly. It proves to the team and to this immensely powerful magical entity that Thomas operates on a higher moral plane.
Wow.
Because he refuses to abandon the statue, the djinn who owes them a debt of gratitude for her freedom intervenes. She uses her unrestrained magic to literally rip the heavy stone statue right out of the earth and load it onto the flying boat.
Which is just incredible.
Thomas didn't have the magical power to break the petrification spell.
Right.
But his absolute unyielding commitment inspired an outside force to do the impossible for him.
That is a staggering way to reframe it. He didn't just manage the crisis. He transformed the capabilities of the people and entities around him by holding the line on a core value.
Exactly.
It manifests a complete victory out of a guaranteed failure, and he barely makes it. He does that cinematic leap onto a trailing rope as the boat ascends, narrowly dodging a Vaglari stinger. It is the perfect synthesis of everything we've talked about.
It requires all of those distinct gears turning together to survive the environment.
So if you're listening to this, how do you map these high fantasy mechanics onto your own life? What we've seen in the Destroyer's Keep is a remarkably complex blueprint for navigating high-stakes, deeply uncertain environments.
Right. You might not be dodging scorpion stingers or fighting wraiths, but the psychological mechanisms of surviving a crisis are exactly the same.
First, it requires profound empathy. Taking the time to respectfully build a cairn for Randall wasn't a distraction.
No, it was a targeted tactic to disarm a hostile situation by validating the humanity of the opponent.
Second, it demands calculated audacity. When you are dealing with a toxic, fear-based system, whether that's an authoritarian regime or just a highly dysfunctional corporate hierarchy, you have to understand how middle management operates.
Thomas bluffed Shadow by weaponizing the bureaucracy against itself. He understood that their fear of making a mistake was greater than their suspicion.
Third, it requires rigorous, almost brutal verification. You cannot trust assumptions when the stakes are existential. Thomas had to be cruel to test Lord April.
He had to demand physical proof of readiness. Relying on hope instead of verified intelligence in a crisis is a fast track to disaster.
And finally, it demands unyielding conviction. You have to know what your non-negotiables are. Thomas refusing to leave without the Lord Protector seems like a tactical error, but it provided the moral anchor his team and the Djinn needed to achieve the impossible when the environment descended into total chaos.
Improvisation, empathy, verification, and conviction. These are your real-world tools. The set dressing changes. The armor and the magic are just metaphors. But human nature, and the nature of complex systems under stress, remains remarkably consistent.
As we close out this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering mystery from the text. Something to really mull over.
Okay.
In the middle of this chaos, while they were discussing escape routes, there was a brief, haunting conversation about something called the Siege, a magical gateway in the courtyard, and the Void, the world in between.
Right.
Thomas suspects that his 15 years of missing memories and his current state as a houseless wanderer are the direct result of previously falling into this void while interacting with the Destroyer's magic.
He essentially paid for his survival with his own history.
Right. And I want you to ponder this. What happens to our identity when we are caught in the void between who we once were and who we are forced to become by our circumstances?
Oh, wow.
When you go through a massive, system-shocking crisis, you rarely come out the other side as the exact same person. Is the loss of our past or the shedding of our former identity sometimes the exact psychological price required to survive the present?
It is a heavy thought. True adaptation often requires a profound kind of forgetting.
Let that sit with you. The next time you find yourself staring at a sterile whiteboard in a crisis meeting, listening to someone drone on about synergies and pivot strategies, just remember, sometimes the most effective strategy isn't written on the board at all. Sometimes it's having the courage to stop the fight, look your opponent in the eye, and start building a cairn. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.